Good morning. This is Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. In this hour, we're talking about flood recovery efforts in northern Wisconsin, recent police killings and shootings, and the race for Bayfield County District Attorney. The election is August 9th. But first, we recap ongoing efforts to repair damage after the July 11th storm. This week, Governor Scott Walker asked federal emergency managers to do early estimates of flood losses. County and state officials say flooding has caused more than $36 million in damages to roads and more than 300 homes and businesses. And yesterday, northern Wisconsin experienced a double whammy, as one Ashland County official put it. Damaging winds swept from the Twin Ports to Ironwood, Michigan, downing trees and power lines and leaving more than 20,000 without power. Some are still waiting for the lights to come back on as temperatures climb in the region. Cooling centers have been set up in Red Cliff, Washburn, Ashland, and Mellon so people can beat the heat. Less than an hour ago, we spoke with Wisconsin Emergency Management's Todd Pritchard to get an update on where things stand with flood recovery efforts and recap what's happened this week.
Well, I think as of today, as of Friday, we've gotten a much better handle on how much damage there is throughout northern Wisconsin and the dollar totals for that. So we're still expecting a few more estimates to come in, but we're currently, for roads to public infrastructures like roads and bridges and that kind of thing, we're currently at about $34 million. And I think that's going to be pretty close to the final number that we'll end up having. Again, there's a few more estimates that'll be coming in, and there could be some changes, but I think that's going to be pretty close to our initial number. And then next week, we will be meeting with Federal Emergency Management Agency folks from FEMA. They will be coming in and joining us for assessments and reviews of those initial damage estimates.
And do you have any idea yet what cities or counties will be visited?
We're working on the schedule right now, but it's going to start in Madison on Monday at 10 o'clock. So we're going to have everyone's going to get together here in Madison first and meet to go over the game plan and assign different teams to different parts of the state. So it looks like we're going to have four teams of FEMA and Wisconsin Emergency Management folks fanning out across the northern part of the state to do those evaluations.
And there's been a lot of work to get those evaluations done this week. I know that the governor had authorized eight teams from the National Guard to assist people working on roads and repairs. Can you just kind of give us a recap of some of the things that have been happening this week?
Sure, and that was a key part of what happened this week. The National Guard did a fantastic job of teaming up with the Wisconsin Department of Transportation and then different counties and towns to evaluate some of the damage that folks in the more rural parts of the state, more rural parts of the damaged counties, just didn't have the expertise to really evaluate. So those teams of engineers made terrific progress. They evaluated over 181 different damage locations. They are currently finishing up their estimates on those damages and will be giving those to the county. And of course, then we'll get a read on them either later today, probably more like on Monday, we'll probably get those final damage estimates in.
Well, and some of the big developments this week was that, Bad River had a multi-agency relief center that was set up to help give people meals and other supplies and cleaning kits. There have been lots of flood kits passed out, and people have been urged across several counties to test their well water to make sure it's safe to drink, and it looks like now that's the case. Another thing this week was that U.S. Highway 2 reopened to all traffic. What's next in the process? I mean, today state officials are going to be visiting several cities up north.
Right. So, the Red Cross did a terrific job along with several other agencies to help get relief to the folks up on the Bad River Reservation. And that's still going to be a long-term process. There were a lot of homes that were damaged, and there are still folks that are out of their homes and will need assistance. So that's being being worked on right now, but the Red Cross did an outstanding job. Kudos to them for responding so quickly and getting help up there so fast to the folks. And you're right. Having Highway 2 open is a huge plus. Obviously, that's the lifeline of travel, commerce, and having that open and ready to go is great. I just urge folks to you know, obey the speed limit, make sure they're not going too darn fast up there, because even though the highway is open now, there are going to be sections of it that there might be some loose gravel, there might be some sections that have temporary repairs on them that will need to be you know, more completed later on. So just, you know, take your time, slow down a little bit, make sure that you're not going through areas that still have are a little rough around the edges, but certainly are open and ready for travel, for tourism, you know, that kind of thing. Obviously, we know that, you know, so many folks are going to be heading up to the Northwoods throughout the summer here, and it's great that so many roads are reopened. And the few that are still closed, there are good workarounds, detours that are not excessive that I think as far as tourism goes, as far as people visiting and having a great time up on the lakes of northern Wisconsin, they're good to go.
Again, that was Todd Pritchard with Wisconsin Emergency Management. And state officials are holding meetings in northern Wisconsin this morning to hear from people about what's needed in the flood recovery effort. One meeting just wrapped up in Hurley. Officials will head next to the Northern Great Lakes Visitor Center in Ashland for a meeting at 11:30 and then travel on to Hayward for a meeting at the Veterans Community Center at 3:30 this afternoon. Still to come, we'll talk with Bayfield County District Attorney candidates Fred Borg and Kim Lawton, Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander, and Superior African Heritage Communities Kim Young on police killings and shootings. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Hear Me Out. Good morning. This is Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. Glad to have you with us. In this hour, we've been talking about flood recovery efforts in northern Wisconsin. And up next, we hear from candidates running for Bayfield County District Attorney. The next DA will be decided during the election on August 9th. And up first, we hear from the incumbent, Bayfield County District Attorney Fred Borg. Borg has more than 30 years of experience as an attorney, serving as both a prosecutor and a state public defender.
Well, the primary reason why I ran was that there were things happening in Bayfield County in terms of criminal justice that were really unacceptable in terms of how cases were being disposed of in exchange for payments, where sometimes the criminal complaints would be filed, sometimes not, and things were being done in exchange for the payment of money. And that doesn't happen anymore. It ceased immediately as soon as I came into office. The another significant aspect of what was happening in this office was that in cases where the allegation was domestic abuse, there's a federal statute that if a person is convicted of a crime of domestic abuse, that their firearms privileges would essentially go away. And so the previous district attorney would often negotiate cases to limit convictions on domestic violence to take off the domestic violence aspect so that the person's firearms privileges wouldn't be affected. And I promised the folks here in Bayfield County that I was going to change that. And since I've been in office, I don't negotiate cases based on gun rights. It's not part of my job, and the fact that there's a federal statute affecting people's gun rights on domestic violence really doesn't have anything to do with the way that I prosecute cases. It is the law, but it's not a law that is enforced at the state level. It's a federal law, and I'm following the state law pretty much to the T. There's a reason why the legislature put in a domestic violence aspect that can be prosecuted, and I think that it's important to the integrity of this system that that prosecutors recognize that and follow those laws. So those are probably the two primary aspects. The other another thing that I've tried to do more intensively than what was happening before was to adopt evidence-based decision-making practices in treatment courts. And Brenda Spurlock, who is our criminal justice coordinator here, and I have worked together some pretty long hours trying to get programs running. And it pretty much starts in my office in terms of making charging decisions in terms of who qualifies for treatment programs. And it's been a very successful program, and we're trying to expand. Right now we're talking about instituting a domestic violence treatment court mode that adopts evidence-based decision-making. And it's pretty much a nationwide trend right now to go towards that, because it's really a problem-solving way to deal with criminal justice. And by taking that approach, I think you put a much bigger dent in future events. The rehabilitation of individuals, I think, happens at a much higher rate, where you don't get nearly as much recidivism. And so far, that's borne out with our programs.
So I guess, you know, kind of taking a larger view of your office, then, would you say that domestic violence cases make up a great deal of your caseload, or what is your caseload currently comprised of?
Well, right now, and for about the last year and a half to 2 years, the primary what I've seen happen in this office is a couple of different things. The influx of methamphetamine in Bayfield County has been overwhelming, which has increased the number of property crimes and also some violent crimes. It also has had an effect on domestic violence issues in a lot in regard to sexual assaults. And if I could track it back to one particular thing happening, it would be the influx of methamphetamine. And I've spent a great amount of time dealing with not only the distribution aspects of methamphetamine, but also the other ramifications from that, all the burglaries that involve meth addicts going into homes or cabins and stealing to, you know, just to raise money to be able to continue to use. It's stunning how powerful of an addiction it is. We've recently prosecuted who we think was like the drug kingpin here, and that person was sentenced to 20 years in prison, 12 years of initial incarceration, and 8 years on extended supervision. That just happened 2 or 3 weeks ago here. There were 14 people named in a conspiracy to distribute methamphetamine. They're all charged. We've got, I think, four other people that have already been convicted, some to prison time, additional prison time, and there are, I think, 8 or 9 people where the cases are still open that we're still working on, working towards convictions on those as well. That's been the primary focus, and how it shows up statistically, and this is true for a lot of the counties around here. I've checked with other DAs, and the ratio of felony charges to misdemeanors used to be about 3 or 4 to 1, where every 3 or 4 misdemeanors you'd be charging a felony. Now it's equal. It's exactly often now we're seeing case numbers coming down, where whatever the case number would be for the felonies, because they're cumulative. So if we're on case number 16 CF-150 is a felony, 16 CF or CM-150 are being filed at the same time, which is, that's an enormous change. I mean, just in terms of the criminality and all the different things that are going on that have escalated now up to felony level just because of the influx of that drug. And the next thing that's coming is heroin. And Douglas County right now has seen a big increase in heroin use, and Bayfield County now we're starting to see it. It's coming in more and more. And right now there's a statewide effort to deal with the narcotics aspect, and there's going to be funding available to deal with that. But those are the primary kinds of cases that we're dealing with right now, and it is overwhelming. Bayfield County is a one prosecutor county. I don't have help, And just to give you an example, last year in Ashland County, where there's two full-time district attorneys, they filed, I believe it was around 245 felony cases. And in Bayfield County, I believe the number was 210. So that's how close we are. There's two full-time attorneys over there. And in this county, there's just one prosecutor.
What do you see as the major challenges then moving forward if you're reelected?
Just continuing this battle. Probably the biggest focus is going to be to start amping up regarding the influx of the heroin, and developing a treatment court that will help deal with that type of addiction, because these addictions are not the same. An addiction to methamphetamine is a certain kind of thing that we are dealing with right now. We've got all the programming set up for that in treatment court, and my guess is we'll be expanding the treatment court to address the narcotic aspect of that is coming with the heroin. And then all the side issues that go along with that. One of the things that's helpful in terms of doing the treatment court, and including like a domestic violence treatment court, is that everyone has to go through more training. Domestic violence cases, just as an example, are peculiar cases in terms of how the evidence usually develops. Right now, within the last probably 4 or 5 months, we've instituted a new approach in terms of determining initial risk, where a victim is questioned, and we go through what's called a lethality assessment to determine right off the bat what kind of dangers would be existent in that particular relationship or that situation. And that documentation comes into my office so that when I make bail recommendations, I can specifically address those risks and asking for certain types of conditions. So there's a lot of work like that needs to get done to be perfected. As we're developing these new programs, they're certainly not perfect, but as you go along, the more you do them, you can work out the bugs, and it really allows you to have much greater foresight in terms of foreseeing outcomes in terms of what kind of work you need to do in order to sustain a good conviction rate.
Given that you're running for re-election, tell us a little bit about why you're doing that, and why people should vote for you as opposed to your challenger, Kim Lawton.
Well, probably the primary reason is that people that vote for me are definitely going to get their money's worth. I'm not a young attorney. I've been doing this work for 36 years. For the last 25 years, I've been doing primarily criminal work in the criminal courts. My trial work has exceeded just about anyone that I know up in this part of the country. I've tried hundreds of cases, and primarily criminal cases. I was a staff public defender for 10 years, and my primary practice before I was elected to district attorney was in criminal courts. This is not my first stint as a prosecutor. When I was a young guy, a bazillion years ago, I was a prosecutor down in Joliet, in Illinois, and learned a lot of techniques and things as a young lawyer that have served me pretty well. And I think it's really an experience factor. My opponent, Ms. Lawton, doesn't have that experience. She has a desire. She wants to learn. But there's what I'm telling my constituents is there's really no need to change horses, that the work is getting done. It's getting done well by a really experienced, seasoned lawyer. And they're getting a lot of bang for their buck, in terms of competency. So that's what I bring to the table.
Again, that was Bayfield County District Attorney Fred Borg. Up next, we hear from challenger Kim Lawton.
I have founded Lawton Law Office in 2012 in Ashland. I work in both Ashland and Bayfield counties. And what I do there, I really shaped my law firm to match my beliefs. I am a strong advocate for domestic violence, for protection of children, for access to justice. I believe that everybody deserves to be able to have representation in court. And so I've really focused my law firm to reflect those beliefs. And so that's what I do right now. My background, I graduated from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln with a Juris Doctor, and I graduated with distinction. I also worked for the Nebraska Attorney General's Office and the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. At the Attorney General's Office, I did criminal appeals and also public protection. And then at the Department of Corrections, I worked in a variety of different areas. And one of my favorite places to work was actually in a prison, where I could see firsthand how the criminal justice system played out. And I think that experience, it brings a definite unique perspective to what I'm running for with running for DA.
So what would you hope to accomplish then if elected to the office of the Bayfield County District Attorney?
I think the first thing I would want to accomplish is just getting things cleaned up. In Bayfield County, we have the worst clearance rate in all of Wisconsin for felony cases, which means, really, it means that we have the most clogged up felony caseload in all of Wisconsin. Now, we have a pretty small population county compared to, obviously, Milwaukee or Madison. There's no reason that we should have such a clogged up county. And what the clogged up system does is it creates such inefficiencies with how people can be protected. So if there's a crime victim, they are not protected as quickly as they need to be because the system is so clogged up, and they keep having to come back to court and having multiple court dates to accomplish, sometimes to end up to accomplish nothing. One of the other issues is not just about the victims, but as the community as a whole. If we look at defendants, we have quite a bit of defendants right now with methamphetamine or alcohol abuse, and they aren't getting resolution to their cases quickly either. So that means that they're not either getting the help they need right away, they're not getting into either jail or prison right away, if that's what's called for, and we end up where we have multiple felony jail jumpings, we have multiple other cases that keep arising, in part due to the clogged up system. And then if you also talk about even the fiscal aspect of it, you end up costing the taxpayers so much more money because it's inefficient. You end up having law enforcement has to keep coming to these court dates over and over and take time from doing their important work out on the streets. You have attorneys who continually have to have cases dragged on, and that money racks up. And then you end up having the cost to the victim where they miss work or they have other costs, like if they're continuing in counseling and stuff. So, and then the emotional cost of just not being able to move past it. So I think that's something that I would like to do right away, is develop policies and bring technology so that we can make the efficient system that needs to be there. And that'd be one of my first priorities.
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up, because one of the things that your opponent or the sitting DA has mentioned is that Bayfield County is a one prosecutor county. So, you know, if you were elected as the DA, how would you hope to accomplish that? You know, I mean, do you think it's a nature of the person sitting in the office that these things are happening, or the fact that there's one position and one person can't do it all?
I think, to be honest, across the board, prosecutors in Wisconsin are facing that challenge. And across the board, what you're seeing in some of these races is the newer generation of attorneys saying, look, I know how to do technology. I'm not afraid of going paperless. I'm not afraid of speeding up the process. And I'm not afraid to explore this new technology that we can get things accomplished quicker. One of the things specifically happening right now is that law enforcement, I know law enforcement in Bayfield County has a disconnect right now with the Bayfield County District Attorney's Office, and where they are repeatedly asked for reports saying, can you bring me this report again, or please follow up on this again? And law enforcement has told me, we've already given the reports over. We've already done this work. Why are we duplicating work? We need to be out there on the streets doing our important job and investigating what we have right now and not trying to follow up on cases 8-10 months later. And so I think that's part of it. The district attorney's office has access to the report, the digital report system, and that law enforcement uses. And right now, I don't believe that that is being utilized within the district attorney's office. And I think that'll speed it up. So I think there is a lack of resources, but we can fix that issue with using what we have available to us and using it efficiently.
Okay. And, you know, I also wanted to ask you what you think the role is of that office, and what are some of the major issues facing it right now?
So I've kind of alluded to it with the efficiency of the court system, but some of the major issues would be substance abuse in the community, needing accountability for violent offenders, and also working with law enforcement. Those are some of the main issues. And I think that the role of the district attorney is really to protect our community and build community and actively work to reduce crime, is to educate everyone about public safety matters. It's to work with law enforcement and social services to combat racial disparities, strengthen treatment alternatives and diversions, and to bring charges and protect the most vulnerable in our community. And I think that without follow through, that does not happen. And I think it's completely unacceptable that at the end of the day, some victims do not know whether or not they are going to be protected. And they have, it's completely unacceptable to have a case dismissed, either eve of trial or just at the last minute, maybe the week before trial, and have that victim scrambling to figure out safety for them and their children. And that, I think, is where, to be honest, that's what led me to run, because I would see that over and over in my work, is that you'd have these families scrambling to figure out their own safety, and that should never happen. There should never be a scramble at the end to find out whether or not a person who is a predator in our community is going to be able to come back to that home or be able to be released from jail that day. There shouldn't be that scramble. And so that's what led me to run. That's what led me to run.
It sounds like there are some dueling priorities as far as the district attorney's office. How would you prioritize the work that needs to be done through that office if elected?
You know, I think that what's great about Wisconsin is we have guidelines for certain types of offenses, like OWI. There's guidelines, and we can expect the judge, absent extraordinary circumstances, will usually follow those guidelines. There's no reason that we couldn't have internal policies at the district attorney's office to have similar guidelines. Something that we see routinely are disorderly conducts. If someone has no prior record, that case should come into the office and be treated exactly like most of the other cases, exactly where we have guidelines set up, so we know what we're going to do with that type of case. So then you don't have to waste time trying to figure out, oh, well, this person had this, I guess you shouldn't have to waste time using judgment when it's the same judgment that needs to be made all the time. And maybe I stated that a little bit off. You always need judgment to be able to look at the whole circumstance. But But in a lot of the cases, I think that you can at least put them in general categories and just streamline the process.
That was Kim Lawton. She's running against Bayfield County DA Fred Borg. You can hear extended interviews with the candidates on our website at wpr.org/superior. We hope to have that posted later today. People can cast votes for their candidate on August 9th. Still to come, we'll talk with Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander and Superior African Heritage Community's Kim Young about recent police killings and shootings and what can be done to end the violence. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Hear Me Out. Good morning. This is Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading and glad to have you with us. In this hour, we've been talking about flood recovery efforts in northern Wisconsin and candidates running for Bayfield County District Attorney. Up next, we talk about recent police killings and shootings across the country with Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander. He talks about what it's like to put on a badge and go to work in light of rising violence against police.
I think the public recognizes, and it's kind of well known, that law enforcement is kind of considered a family. So, you know, and I guess it works in both directions, that when there are instances that happen, whether it being, you know, in California or Louisiana or some other remote place or in Minnesota, that a lot of times every officer is kind of grouped into, you know, to that category of a police officer. So, you know, we feel the criticism that, you know, based on actions of other departments, other officers, and so on. So, you know, that's one of the things that's difficult about it. I kind of lost my train of thought on the question there. Could you refresh me again?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I just, you know, what it's like for, you know, someone in your role to get up and go to work every day.
Sure. And then on the same token, now it's with, you know, I believe at least 8 law enforcement officers killed in the last couple weeks, kind of the same thing, that I believe it's fair to think that our officers wake up with a little bit more anxiety and a little bit more concern for their safety when they prepare for work, when they put that blue uniform on and badge and go out to protect and serve the community. I think that they are experiencing a heightened sense of concern for their safety and a little bit of you know, fear of the unknown. That, yeah, that bad things happened in Dallas and Baton Rouge, but just because we're Superior, Wisconsin, or some smaller community, it doesn't mean that that couldn't happen here.
Well, and President Obama came out, I think, this week and wrote an editorial in the Washington Post saying that, police, we have your backs. And I guess, you know, my question to you is, what does that feel like to you? What would make you feel like people were behind you or had your back?
You know, I read President Obama's letter, and I think that, you know, he articulated, you know, I think, strong points to address to the American public about supporting law enforcement, and that certainly there's going to be incidents that, you know, are going to require closer looks at, and it's, we're not a perfect profession. Mistakes are going to be made, but overall, that it's an institution that's designed to protect and serve, and overwhelmingly, that's what it's the officers do for it. So, I mean, hearing the president or seeing those words is certainly of support. I think probably for your average cop, what's probably more touching is the community members bringing in treats for the officers or sending in letters of support and appreciation. Down in somewhere in the cities, there's a group of people who have gone out every night and held a candlelight vigil to support law enforcement. So it's nice to see the President of the United States, put some words behind support for law enforcement. But I think, at the local level, it's those actions that I think, you know, strike a chord more with our police officers. And we've seen that here. We've had groups bring in donuts and cookies, and we receive multiple letters and cards thanking us for the work that we do and recognizing that it's a difficult job and that people are thankful that, you know, that there are people who have taken that oath to do that so they can remain safe and secure in their homes and in life.
You know, and I think about why some of these events are happening around the country, and I think that there is a sentiment that exists out there that, you know, the reaction to the police killings, that there has been more notice or attention paid to that than possibly many of the lives that have been lost as a result of police shootings. And what would you say to that, to people who are in minority groups and feel frustrated that, you know, maybe the life of an officer is worth more than the life of an African-American or Native American?
Right. Well, I mean, I think I can empathize with that. I mean, I think that all lives matter, and the loss of any life, regardless of the circumstances, is, you know, is a tragedy. And I certainly can see where they may feel that way. I mean, there was a lot of attention initially from the shootings in Falcon Heights and Louisiana, and then the next week or so when we saw, you know, five officers killed, 12 wounded in Dallas, and then another mass shooting of the police in Louisiana, that, you know, that kind of, I guess, stole the headlines, I suppose, you know, for lack of a better word. You know, I think there's a little bit of a difference in the sense that the deaths of the officers in this case, they had, you know, they were multiple. They were, and I guess, you know, for me, it seems like somebody going out there with the intent of killing multiple officers, kind of ambushing them, you know, that there was, you know, to me, it feels like there was more malicious intent there, whereas, and certainly I'm probably slanted because I'm a law enforcement officer and the son of one as well, but I really don't believe that any officer woke up on those days with the idea that they want to go out and cause harm or kill an African-American or any other citizen. I think that those incidents are tragic because that's how they ended up, but I think there's a little difference there in terms of the motivation and intent, and, you know, I think maybe that might be something that the public kind of sees as well.
Well, and what do you think can be done, if anything, to help dispel perceptions that may be not based in fact but emotion, or to end violence or fear that we're seeing right now around police shootings or killings?
You know, it's a great question, and it's very difficult. And one of the words that you said that's kind of struck a chord was fear, because I think that that's these chain of events are, that's kind of what they're doing. They're creating fear. There's fear in the communities of color that law enforcement is targeting them or treating them differently than others, and that they have a greater likelihood of being victims of violence by law enforcement. And then there's law enforcement now who sees mass shootings of law enforcement that, at least in many people's minds, is somewhat in retaliation for those other shootings. So there's this mutual fear that I think, and it kind of creates kind of a perpetual recipe for bad things to happen. You know, officers that are experiencing greater concern for their officer safety, I mean, there's the chance of hypervigilance and reacting differently because they have, you know, a heightened sense of concern for their safety. And I think the same goes for communities of color. If they have contacts with law enforcement and it's their expectation or fear that bad things are going to happen, I mean, it probably influences those interactions too and increases the chance that bad things can happen. And I don't know what the easy solution is. I mean, obviously partnerships, communication, we can't let that break down. I mean, I think we've been doing a good job in the Northland with that, both in Duluth and Superior, and I'm sure it's in many other communities around the country too, that law enforcement officials and communities of color and advocacy groups and so on, you know, meet and discuss and talk about the challenges that we face. And, you know, fortunately in the Northland here, we haven't seen incidents like the ones that, you know, have made national headlines, but you'd also be naive to say that they couldn't happen here, because they certainly could. But, you know, I tell my officers that, you know, we have a job to do. We have a mission. The Superior Police Department is sworn to protect, committed to justice, and dedicated to professional service. And if we perform our jobs with that in mind and follow our training, that we shouldn't get involved in, we shouldn't be the, I guess, in the microscope of public criticism, because the work that we've done will have been appropriate and justified. And I, I try to tell them to have confidence in, in that and doing the right thing. When they do the right thing, it's going to turn out okay.
Well, and it sounds just like a lot of it comes down to trust. And I know that that's been a big focus for your department in building that trust between groups. Do you see success with that? Do you feel like you're making those connections to help bring people together?
You know, it's frustrating as the chief of an organization, because I do think, I look back to the last year and a half, that I've been chief, and I do think that we've made some inroads and progress in increasing trust and dialogue and conversation with, various communities of color here in Superior, and we have good open lines of communication. And then these incidents that happen in other parts of the country, it's kind of that, one cop is every cop kind of thing, kind of erodes at it a little bit. So, it's frustrating in that sense that I do think that some of these other incidents have kind of taken a block out of the wall, or put a block back on a wall that we, have maybe taken down already, and because we haven't had those incidents here, and I'm hopeful that we won't. But what happens on the national level does impact us here, and so in that sense it's frustrating. My commitment remains the same, and I've reached out to various community leaders and told them that my vision and expectation for this department is that our officers treat all people with dignity and respect and fairness and equity, and when they do that, they really shouldn't have any issues, defending the decisions or work actions that they take.
That was Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander. Up next, we hear from Kim Young with the Superior African Heritage Community about what she'd like to see to bring an end to the violence.
I don't feel like they're being treated seriously enough from a legislative standpoint. The police, however, in our communities have been doing a wonderful job in trying to find ways to use non-lethal methods to combat, to make sure that any situation they have turns out well for suspects as well as, the police department. In the larger cities, I feel like the voices of the people are not being heard regarding this issue. The fact that they've started using body cameras, and we have all this photographic evidence from people taking recordings on cell phones, but yet it's not being taken seriously. And that is evidence. It's showing the commission of a crime as it's happening. But still, the police aren't being held accountable for these incidents, And it's almost like they, murder for hire. They have impunity towards it. They get a paid vacation. If we don't get paid vacations when we mess up at work and make a mistake that may cost a life or something like that. We get charges and we get fired. They don't. So that in itself tells me that, the system is responsible for this and not taking it seriously. And then it doesn't help when we have situations where our publicly elected officials are not as responsive and not wanting to take up with these issues and deal with them as they need to be. Our police are there to protect and serve. And we know that historically they are there to protect property. That's what they were designed for. But if you are listed as protecting and serving the public, then that's what you need to do. Not become judge, jury, and executioner in the street.
Well, what do you think is the responsibility of public officials with these police shootings? What should they be doing that they're not doing?
They should be looking into, first of all, getting police insured, looking at those contracts with the Fraternal Order of Police, those union contracts that make it so these police officers get those paid leaves, which they shouldn't. That's an incentive to me. They shouldn't be getting paid leaves. They should have insurance. Each officer should carry insurance for these incidents. Many of these departments are paying out civil lawsuits in excess of over $50,000 per incident to families, for these officers, and these officers are still working. still out there carrying a badge. They need to regulate mental health with the officers to make sure that they are prepared for the line of duty, you know, and that they are using their best judgment when it comes to these cases. And a lot of them recently that we've seen, it doesn't seem like they're using judgment. It's just like, you know, just go ahead and shoot them. You know,
well,
and that shouldn't be the way it is either.
I respect the fact that
this is a hard job for police officers, you know, but it's a chosen job, too. And to take someone's life is not something easy, and it shouldn't be an easy choice for you to make, even as a police officer. It should be your last resort.
Well, and I want to ask you about that, because the perception of intent, or the perception of what is taking place at the time these shootings occur, it seems to be a focal point, because when we talk to police about any shootings that have taken place that have involved an officer being put on leave and an investigation, one thing that law enforcement or justice officials are saying is that, you know, you have to take more into account than what a video shows or what a person or a witness says, that, you know, you have to consider what the officer sees. And I just want to get your take on that, you know, as far as the perceptions of, because, I mean, these are situations where sometimes, you know, they're asked to react quickly, and they're supposed to be trained to be able to act in an appropriate way in these situations.
Okay, let's take the case of the man that was just shot in Florida, laying on his back with his hands up. He was a caregiver for an autistic man that he was trying to talk down and get out the road to come in back into their care facility. And the officer shot him, and when the man asked him, he didn't die, thankfully, but when the man asked the officer, why did you shoot me, the officer said, I don't know. So that's a situation where, yeah, the officer needed to think a little bit more about it. He did. You can clearly see on there, you know, he told the man to get down on the ground. The man did, had his hands up in front of him, and the officer still shot him. Let's take the case of Philando Castile. Philando had told him he was a registered gun owner, and the officer asked him to get his ID. He went for his ID to comply, and the officer shot him. What was the justification for that?
Do you think, in the
case of Alton Sterling, two officers were sitting on this man's chest, shot him point blank. We've got video that shows he was not reaching for his gun. He had a gun on him, yes, but he was not reaching for it. So what was the justification for two men to slam him on the car, throw him on the ground, and to shoot him point blank in the chest?
How much do you feel fear plays a role in this? You know, I'm thinking about these officers who are waking up every day, going out on the job, seeing news about police shootings or police killings, and wondering if it's going to be the day that they don't come home. How much do you feel that fear plays a role?
Fear plays a big role. I definitely believe fear plays a big role in this. But it's also that cultural communications part is also a big part of their training. We have been told that officers are trained, you know, to treat the public as enemies, enemy combatants when you're in a situation. And we've been told that they, you know, training, the regular training that officers had been receiving up till now taught them to treat the public as enemy combatants, to treat them as if everybody will lie to you. You know, and to take appropriate measures first. Appropriate measures does not always mean lethal measures. You can use a taser, which we also know can be lethal. You know, you've got six or seven cops there taking down one assailant, and that assailant still ends up dead. That's excessive force. You know, I don't want our police officers dying in the street. I also don't want our people, black, white, yellow, brown, any of us dying in the street. But you're also expecting people who are trained to carry guns, and people are trained, you know, in the arts of non-lethal containment of people in situations. They point guns at people that are unarmed faces every day. But you expect us, who are not trained in dealing with situations like that, to remain calm. That's an illogical premise. You know, there's fear on both sides. There is fear on both sides, and that needs to be combated both in the public and in the police departments.
How do you address the fear? How do you make an end to the violence? What are the first steps that people can take, on whether it's a police officer or an activist or just, you know, a regular everyday Joe walking down the street? What can people do to try and make this situation better?
Well, the first thing, we know you can tell people to comply, and those who have complied also still end up, you know, shot. So one of the things is to relook at the training that police officers get. We are not enemy combatants. There are situations such as, high-powered drug deals and hostage situations where the police need to take, you know, every precaution for their lives, you know, and that is understandable. We do have people out there that are dangerous to the public. That is understandable, but not every situation is going to be a dangerous situation. And we know police officers can't really take those chances, but also they cannot go into these, you know, into a traffic stop, into, you know, a ticket serving or, you know, a warrant serving with the intention, you know, or with the predisposition that this will turn into a violent situation. Yes, that is a possibility, but when you are walking up to people in the community and you're looking at them as if they are enemy combatants and you're expecting violence, then that's also a key to perpetrating violence, because you're expecting somebody that you're protecting to be violent towards you, and that's not always the case. Most people are law-abiding citizens. Most people have a respect for police, but now there's a greater fear of police, a greater fear that no matter what you do, you will get shot or that you may die while you're in jail. And we're seeing cases where suspects, handcuffed, you know, can't do anything, are being harmed in jail as well as in the streets. So then you've got that extra added fear there, you know, and also the way that the mass marketed media, you know, i.e. Fox News and different affiliates on TV are, you know, are portraying these incidents on TV. And what you always see when it comes to communities of color, you see the bad people. That's what they show you. They show you a mugshot to desensitize you to their humanity. You know, we see some white privilege along with that, because you don't see bad mugshots of white people unless they're using drugs, unless they're, you know, a dangerous serial killer. And even then, you might not see them. But there's language associated with that that builds that fear in those police officers. And there's also, you know, those characterizations of people all the time. That helps to build that fear. There's a lot of misunderstanding about people and humanity and who we are as a people of color, and also who police are.
That was Kim Young with the Superior African Heritage Community. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and check us out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM. This has been Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. We hope to have you back with us next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend. And stay cool.